Science, that newfangled thing that causes so much confusion, formerly known as natural philosophy, which if you were trying to call it that now, you'd be in even more trouble trying to get anyone to believe your findings. The thing is, though, that sometimes the findings are in fact wrong. So when does science get it spectacularly wrong? And when, strangely, can that be a good thing? Ted Lefroy is director for the Centre of Environment at the University of Tasmania. Hi, Ted.
Morning, Rick.
Why did you want to look at this topic?
Because I think we're rightly celebrating science all this week. But I think the thing we have to acknowledge is that science, in many people's mind, is on the nose. People are increasingly sceptical. And that can be a good thing. And I think the thing we need to acknowledge is that science is fundamentally a human activity, and therefore it is subject to human frailty. And if you look at where science has backfired, there are I think, four main reasons. There are genuine mistakes, and there's fraud. And those two are usually picked up in the self-correcting process of peer review. If you think you've got a good idea, you have to write it down, you show you're working, you submit it to a journal. A small group of people review it. If it gets past them, it's published. And then thousands of people will look at it. And then often through that double process, those sort of mistakes, that genuine mistakes and fraud, is usually picked up. Okay, there's 1.5 million scientific papers published each year, of which 0.2% are retracted. That's 2,800 roughly out of 1.5 million. So it's a very small percentage with that. I think what is more interesting is the other sources of mistakes are bias and unintended consequences.
Just before that, though, can we just look, talking about fraud, because there was this one going around, because the PR in science is an interesting place. So there was the story going around about how caffeine helps you prevent baldness by this doctor, Adolf Frank Mitchell or whoever he is, in Germany, and everyone was getting pretty excited about that. But he's been a TV doctor for that hair loss product for 25 years. Mm. But they're saying that it's based on scientific work.
And this is the tricky thing about fraud, because it's not the sort of thing you expect, and it makes you realise how much we rely on trust. Perhaps the most spectacular example, what the journal The Lancet called the worst case of scientific fraud in the last, or medical fraud in the last 100 years, was the study that linked the measles rubella vaccine with autism. And that took 12 years from the time it was published in 1998 until that issue was settled in 2010. And what they discovered was the data had been manipulated, but also the lead author had failed to acknowledge that he'd received funds from Legal Aid in Britain, who were representing a group of people who believed that there was a link between this vaccine and autism, and he had been paid to look for evidence. And you are supposed to declare all your sources of funding. So if there's so on two counts, manipulating the data and failing to declare a conflict of interest. But because the process was so cautious, people had to repeat that study numerous times in Britain and America until they finally decided there's no evidence of a link. But, I mean, that caused an awful lot of, you can imagine, the people that didn't and still are not vaccinating. And so people, you know, and that sort of thing, the full story really gets out, does it? People hear the beginning, and so we have this phenomenon of anti-vaxxers. But I think it's worth understanding that sort of fraud and genuine mistake are tiny. But the bigger issues to me, and the ones that we're gradually dealing with, are bias and unintended consequences.
So bias is where you tend to, as we love to do, find exactly what you were looking for.
True.
And shouldn't there be a rule in science that if you find what you're looking for, you instantly have to have alarms going off?
But the trouble with bias is that there's bias not only in the person posing the question and testing it, that often there's a cultural bias amongst the people who review it. And probably the darkest period in science was early in the 20th century, was the whole area of eugenics. Eugenics, just Greek for good breeding. This is the idea.
Turns out, after all, white people are superior to everyone else.
Well, if you go in with that conviction, people kept on finding evidence of that. And there's a surprising number of very famous people were right behind it. And
Enid Blyton, interestingly, if you read her books, you know, she's really into its eugenics ideas and also a little bit the head measuring stuff where she describe her bad creatures always as swarthy, low-browed, barely evolved. You know, I mean, you can see those ideas coming out then, even in children's fiction.
But look, we even though eugenics, it still might be vaguely popular in some parts, it was widely accepted and widely believed. So people reviewing the work, you know, didn't have the filter to detect the bias, and the bias was often unconscious in the way that these studies were carried out. But what that tells you is, you know, science, as I was saying, it's a human activity, it's a cultural phenomenon, and as values change in society, so does the way in which science is conducted. And I think a lot of people think science is a body of knowledge, the stainless steel fixed thing. And you say, is it scientific? Is it not? It's more than anything, it's a method. It's a method for understanding the world around us. And as the society changes, so our rules of evidence change and our expectations change. And, you know, there are more modern examples. If you think of what we call invasive species, biosecurity, big issue. When Australia was first settled, there were acclimatization societies. People were falling over backwards to introduce all the familiar things. Then the pendulum has swung as we've realised the consequences of that. But interestingly, it's now starting to swing back in a way. There was a paper in Science in 2010, in Nature, sorry, called Don't Judge a Species on Its Origin. And what they're really saying is where it comes from is not as important as what it does. So don't just dismiss everything because it's not Australian or not endemic.
Someone was saying a couple of years ago that actually a lot of introduced trees are really good. The limbs don't fall off. They last for a long time. And to be obsessed with only putting in native trees is not necessarily the best way. It's 16 to 7 on 936 ABC Hobart. Ted Lefroy is Director of the Centre for Environment at the University of Tasmania, and for Science Week is posing the question provocatively, as he always does, why does science sometimes get things spectacularly wrong? I think we're in the era, if I was going to sum up this era in relation to science, I think the phrase that sums it up is, I don't believe the science. The fury of scientists with the word believe and science in the same sentence. But it's sort of got to that point.
But there's a healthy side to that, and that is scepticism, genuine scepticism. If you think of it, people used to trust authorities and authority figures to a much greater extent than they do now.
Well, there was a period, wasn't there, where the science took over from the priests.
Absolutely.
And they were believed absolutely.
Yeah, and you know, it's not as if science being on the nose is a new thing. There was a member of the CSIRO board, Professor Masson from Melbourne University, Professor of Chemistry, who said in the 1920s, science is seen as a threat to society, both religious and secular. It did threaten authorities, But you know, instead of just blithely accepting whatever an authority figure or an institutional government say, people do question it. But I think what people often miss is that science, being a cultural phenomenon, is a movable feast. The rules of evidence are changing, our values change, and that's reflected in the way we practice science.
How have the rules of evidence changed?
Well, there's a very interesting series of papers about. Is 5%, there's a kind of 5% rule that if you conduct an experiment and you find, you know, the 95% of the results occurred due to the treatment and only 5% occurred at random, then it's acceptable. It's a kind of a line to say, yes, there is a real, I'm looking at a real effect here. And there is an increasing debate. And there was a paper published, Why Most Published Research Findings Are False, which is a very provocative title. But the person was pointing out it's not only that confidence interval, but there are other factors to do with the statistics, the statistical power of a study that they're really questioning. In some fields, they accept lower standards of evidence than in others. And because the design of experiments can get quite complex, what these people are arguing is we really need to re-look at that bar. We need to raise the bar. Especially because we've now got techniques where you can do thousands of runs of things, either computer models or genetics.
That allowing 5% is too floppy.
Yeah.
The difficulty thing is that, I mean, a lot of people say that their practice is a science. Sociologists or economists, where they're not really sciences. Are they?
Yes, it is. If you
can, they get that level of absolute proof.
Yeah, if you construct a hypothesis and you can find and you can find a way to test it, and you use a statistical design that's sufficiently robust, you have enough statistical power, enough replicates, and the bar is high enough. Yes, it can be. Of course, it can be. But it's just that, you know, that science has diverged into so many different disciplines. Now that the language differs, it's often difficult to understand one or the other, and their rules of evidence vary, and those are continually being questioned.
So how do you know? Because, you know, when you're reading through your newspaper or something, they're saying, "Oh, this study says this, and that study says this, and this study says that." How do you sniff out who's really kind of pulling your chain? That the study's not substantial enough. That it's probably just a PR-backed thing, and is it sample size? If they say we talk to 50 people or we talk to 50,000 people?
First thing is look for the citation. So you can just Google it and find the journal, the scientific journal that it comes from. And if it's peer-reviewed, you've passed one bar. You know that it's been subject to review by peers of the person who submitted it. The next thing is it's easy nowadays. You go to the homepage of the journal and you have a look at its impact factor. And that will tell you the number of times that papers in that journal are cited by other people. Now, none of these are absolutely rigid, but they're very good indicators. If it's published in Nature or Science, which are the two leading journals, one British, one American, then there is an element of trust, and they have gone wrong, and there have been papers retracted from those. But that's a pretty good guide. So, you know, I think the best thing is look for the citation. If you can't find a refereed journal backing up that claim, you have every right to be very sceptical.
And these days you can Google that in the pub while you're having the argument about the spurious statistic that someone's just quoted to you.
And isn't that a good thing? And that's why people now have the ability to inform their own judgment. But that's the thing. The citation is the thing.
Well, we heard about the internet earlier this morning as being a great place to see a koala try and mate with a small motorbike, four-wheel motorbike. Now it's been redeemed. And soon, I was in this running race over the weekend, Ted Lefroy, and the results were going onto the internet live as the legs of the race were being run. Amazing. So maybe it's not just all koalas.
So you can't hide.
You can't hide. Good to talk to you this morning.
You too.